what I'd really hoped to do was to maybe catalyze some further discussion. And it's fascinating listening to whatever you guys were discussing in the last 5 to 10 minutes. So I had hoped that we could sort of facilitate a discussion and then on these two principles. But then I just noticed that we are like 35 participants in this group. So I do not know how that might be possible. But maybe one way to do this is, Justine, I believe that you were earlier divided into groups and there was some work done as groups. So maybe it would be very useful and interesting for me to, let's say, from each group, hear about, let's take the principle of presence first. And from each group, what's your sort of top two or three reasons why why presence as a conservationist, our presence in the field, our presence in the communities is important. I'm sorry, now my dogs are speaking, so I'll shut up and I'll listen to, is that okay? Is that okay for me to throw the question out to the groups or group facilitators?
Yeah, that works great.
From your experiences and as well as from the course, why do you think presence is important? Maybe the top two or three reasons why you think it's important.
So maybe Ajay's team can go first. So the different facilitators maybe can share some of the tips.
Yeah, so I think one of the points that came up, and it was not just our group, but I think it came up through several groups, was the fact that trust is an extremely important aspect. And without trust, it is very hard to be able to work with any community. We also, I think, spoke about how there might be a history to a place that could add to the complexity. So when we get into a landscape, we might have a certain view of it, but seldom do we know about what has brought that community to that point. And so there is a need to be able to understand those complexities by being there, to be really able to open ways to start working with them. I think those were two important points that came up in the first point. I think came up across, and so did the second point in several of the discussions.
Thank you, Ajay. I will come back on this issue, both these issues of trust and what we mean by what we mean when we say, you know, establishing trust, and how does one go about establishing trust, because that's a really important discussion in the context of community-based
Charity, if I can also just add, there was one specific question that had come up and I thought it was useful to bring it. It came from Pravesh and one of the groups about what do we call a community? Because there could be some places where the whole identity of a community may not be very well defined. And if that were the case, how does one really engage with a community, if we were to say so?
Absolutely. One of a very, very fundamental question, but an important one. And maybe we could take that first and then go back to the discussion. I think that this is a challenge that we have faced, actually. Some of our colleagues and collaborators and partners have faced, because in different areas, the whole definition of community is different. For example, in Mongolia, as most of you would know, especially in the Gobi region and others, it's like a people are really, you know, they're nomadic pastoralists, and it's really, you know, your nearest neighbor might be 10 kilometers away. And typically there's one or two gears in a location, one or two families, sometimes even just one, and then the others are much farther away and things like that. So where do you draw those boundaries? Whereas, let's say, a village in the Himalayas is maybe easier in terms of, you know, there's a the entire village is within a tight spatially defined unit, but then there is, you know, move further onwards north to the Tibetan plateau, and then the idea of the village completely changes. You might have a so-called community with maybe thousands of families, right? Still very extensive, still using large parts of the large areas, but then so many people together. So how do you deal with it? What is the unit of operation that you actually work with? So I think that there's a couple of things to keep in mind here. One is that we are, and it's not like, there's no clear definition. It would really have to be done based on the context. In Mongolia, one thing that happened was that the government actually, they started a program under which 10 households together, right? If they aligned together and, you know, fulfilled some basic qualification, then a group of 10 families would be considered a community. And they would then also be able to, they would then be able to benefit from some of those, state-sponsored programs. So that's something which was sort of top-down, but it was made sense in a particular context. And so what our team did was to actually work with those communities. And, you know, there's this community responsible areas, CRAs and stuff that, so for those, or for Snow Leopard Enterprises programs and for various other programs, that is what we are sort of considering as a community. Like I said, in the Himalayas, it could be a village. Typically, they're not very big, 100 families, 200 families. Sometimes there are smaller hamlets with a few, 5, 10, 20 families, et cetera. So we consider them as well as communities as well. In the, let me not go to the Tibetan Plateau example yet, because that gets a bit more complicated. But one of the important things that defines in, for us, for our purposes, what would define a community also, not entirely, it's one of the important characteristics, is what is their, the area that they use? How do they make decisions over that area? How do they use natural resources? Is there any coordination in that? Is there already any coordination in terms of the decisions they make in terms of when an area needs to be grazed or who is allowed to collect whatever produce from those areas? And so is there some kind of a management, and is there some kind of a land tenure which a set of families share? And that itself sort of then gives another way of trying to define a community in terms of the unit that you can actually work with. Because even within villages, there are, in larger villages especially, there tend to be these groups. Because, you know, when the, as we all know, when the groups become too large, then it's difficult to manage, not just as conservationists, but as for the people themselves to manage and make decisions. So typically these so-called in quotes communities or large communities have their own systems of division, where they would have themselves, like in, even in Spiti, in the larger villages, like the one that Ranjini would have spoken about, there's like already, it's not such a huge village, maybe less than 100 families, and yet they have felt the need to divide themselves into three groups based on where their houses are located in the village. So the three groups make their decisions and then they make collective decisions. So the, but the main point being that there are people organize themselves, and I think we need to respect that. So if there are ways already traditional or whatever, relatively new ways in which people have organized themselves, as long as these are, you know, equitable and, you know, have inclusive decision-making, we could define those as being our units as far as community work is concerned. But in certain cases, it's much easier and the number of families is not huge. An entire village could be defined as a community. In other cases like Mongolia, it's something that it's brought in by the government, but then it helps us as well, because these families are typically those that manage the land together and make decisions about the land together. They already have a system, they already have a, you know, this kind of a, in some sense, integration as a coordinated group. So it makes sense for us also to work with them. And so if you look at it from a landscape perspective, again, you know, then it becomes easier because the entire landscape, we are interested in landscape species. We are interested in conserving landscape species. You'd have discussed it in the context of aptness, you know, like Justine was saying towards the end, snow leopards may move, you know, home ranges of more than 100 square kilometers. As the crow flies, they could move 40, 50, 60 kilometers. So easily, you know, moving from one community's land into the other. So here again, it sort of, it helps in terms of trying to understand, okay, if this is a community, what's its area of influence? Where's the next community? What is this its area of influence? And if we are interested in a landscape species, perhaps we need to be working with both. So no simple answer, but I think it really those what we define as communities would need to be done in a very contextual manner and looking at the ground situation. Does that help? Sorry, it was a long answer to a simple question, but it is a complex issue. And it's a good question.
Yes. Thanks, Charlie. I can see Juliet is raising her hand. So Juliet, if you would like to.
Yes, I was. Thank you, Charu. And you're right, there are never any simple answers to these to these questions. And I fear that the question I'm going to ask you is again, not very simple, but very, I think, very important. Because we have been discussing the issue of aptness. And it's, I think it's very important that you highlighted this issue of, well, of the scale at which we can work and you know how you define a community, etc. But I was wondering whether you could maybe enlighten us on how we can create sort of enabling conditions at the level of the whole community in order to really develop the most sort of tailored or apt programs. In a conservation setting.
And before that, can I just jump in? Charu, how would you define aptness? I think there's some confusion in the group as well. What is aptness? And it would be great to have put you on the spot to get a definition.
Can't you keep it simple? I think I think in very simple terms, what is the relatively most appropriate thing to do, right? In a given context, with a given community, in a given situation, at a given time. So it's like as against us going in with some great ideas, or great solutions. We think we've got some great solutions. And, you know, I've written about that example in a book where I felt, you know, this was in Eastern Himalayas in Arunachal Pradesh, where I felt that, you know, I'd been working for so many years with our communities here in Spiti and other places. And this was a new community that we wanted to, at that time, there was a plan to partner with them. And I knew exactly what they needed, right? Even before having these discussions with them, because I had done some surveys and, you know, about livestock depredation, the kind of losses they face. I had spent some time there, but really it was more from an ecological perspective, trying to do some biodiversity surveys, etc. But I went there thinking, okay, I know exactly what these guys need. And, you know, they need an insurance program, they need this, they need that. And it's like, it takes a long time to even get there, you know, to get to Arunachal Pradesh, to drive to this part of the, and then sort of trek for 2 days, sleep in the forest for 1 day or whatever, and then get there. And of course, I was politely sent back, you know, because I had no, from their perspective, I had no clue what I was talking about, and they were absolutely right. So I think the just simple as it may sound, but just trying to figure out what is an appropriate, let's say, and this is more in the context of interventions, right? What is an appropriate kind of intervention for a given community? And no amount of science by itself, science is critical, like Justine indicated in that little bit that I caught at the end, but no amount of science, whether it's, you know, ecological or social, will actually be able to tell us what is really, you know, tell us in a foolproof manner what's going to be appropriate for this community or with what can we do which would be with this community that would make sense both for them as well as the biodiversity and snow leopards that we're trying to protect. So it's really about asking ourselves what would be the amongst the range of things that are possible, what are the most appropriate things to do? And to be able to answer that, you have to look at multiple factors. You know, again, some of those that we were listing earlier, or Justine was touching upon, others mentioned it too. I think Hussein wrote in the discussion about, in the chat box, about trophy hunting programs. That's a perfect example that, you know, I've written about it as well. And for Hussein, and in that context, in the context of Pakistan, in the context of Islamic communities and even Christian communities, which have more sort of a fundamental philosophy of stewardship of wildlife, stewardship and use of wildlife, sustainable use of wildlife. And that's the both from a religious perspective as well as from a practical perspective, that's sort of been the paradigm and that's sort of been the approach. And you know, you don't have to bat an eyelid to say, okay, you know, we were able to, other things we did enabled us and started, created conditions for starting a trophy hunting program. But it would be very foolish if we tried to do the same thing. I mean, in India, again, we have both Islamic communities and Buddhist communities and others, you know, across a landscape. And it would be very stupid of us to try and invoke or start discussions on a trophy hunting program with a Buddhist community, right? Because there they are talking about, their leaders and spiritual leaders are talking about interdependence of all forms of life and how we are all related and how it's really about interconnectedness. It's not so much about stewardship. It is about interconnectedness and the need to protect other forms of life. And so that's a non-starter in such communities, right? Of course, in Northeast India, we have communities who are animistic, traditionally still animistic. Hunting is a very important part of the tradition. Many of them in the 1800s and early 1900s converted into Christianity, but they retain their hunting traditions. It's a different matter that our national laws would not allow something like this. But those are the, from a cultural perspective, those are contexts where you can discuss, let's say, a trophy hunting program. It would be apt, perhaps, to discuss that as a conservation tool, or it would be apt to discuss a trophy hunting program as a conservation tool in Pakistan, but not perhaps the Buddhist areas in India and China, some of our countries. So that's a sort of a trying to assess cultural aptness. Science is something that Justine's already touched upon. I think you guys also talked a bit about social capital and the available skills and resources. Now, if our communities are just not traditionally have not produced handicrafts, let's say, unlike Spiti, where there's been a tradition, unlike Mongolia, some of our communities, or Kyrgyzstan, if we went to a community with the whole idea of trying to create a handicrafts program without considering that they may not have had any tradition of doing this, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but then let's not think that, you know, we go there and it's just a matter of getting people to agree to it, because the kind of time, investment, and resources it will need to actually get people to become interested, to actually get help develop those skills and so on, that's a completely different ballgame than trying to sort of export SLE into a community which already has some tradition of, you know, maybe some woolen products and things like that. So that's the available skills. So there's a multitude of things, Juliet. Again, a complex answer to be a simple question. But obviously, as you know, there's these multiple ways in which we really need to be able to assess what's appropriate or not. And like Justine pointed out, it changes over time. It changes over space, it changes over time. So something that might make a lot of sense today, let's say a livestock insurance program might make a lot of sense, or it may have made a lot of sense in some of our communities 20 years ago, but over time they have, you know, they've sort of, their dependence on livestock as a way of, you know, as the most important source of livelihood has shifted. I mean, it's from livestock, it has shifted to agriculture, to cash crops. And so if we really think about programs that could benefit them much better, maybe we have to think of something else and not a livestock insurance program. So these things change over time as well. Okay?
Great. That's really helpful. Thank you so much, Terry. So we're getting to the end of our session this morning, but I would like to just thank everyone for being so interactive and being so generous in sharing your experiences and your knowledge with all of us. I think I certainly have already learned a huge amount more on the two principles of presence and aptness. But also, I think what's been really interesting is that a lot of other aspects have come out in the discussions today around the issue of better understanding communities, of better understanding the context in which conservation interventions take place, and also in terms of, you know, really this issue of building trust, of going both ways, but also really of implementing actions that are, you know, really tailored and really contextualized in a way that makes it beneficial for both the community and conservation. And I think what we'll see over the next few weeks is that, because already what was interesting was that a number of the other principles, not just presence and aptness, but a number of the other principles have already been touched upon today in our discussions. And I think what will be interesting over the next few weeks is to see those interlinkages becoming more and more apparent, and really looking at the partners' principles as a whole rather than separate components that may not be linked to each other.